Hello, lovelies. My name is Caitlin, and welcome to another episode of True Crime with Caitlin. Today, I'm going to be telling you all about a young girl who holds the title of Britain's youngest female murderer and the horrific crime that she committed, which earned her the name the Devil's Daughter. This is the case of Sharon Carr and the murder of Katie Ratcliffe. Katie Ratcliffe was born in 1974 and grew up in Hawley, Surrey. She came from a really nice, normal, loving family, and she had a pretty happy, regular upbringing thanks to her parents, Helen and Joseph. Katie was one of these people who had their whole life planned out. She knew what she wanted, and she began working hard, determined to get there. She had recently started working in a salon as an apprentice hairdresser, and to her, this was the first step towards achieving her dream of owning and running her own salon. Here, Katie really thrived. She was a social butterfly, she was chatty, she was well liked by all of the clients, she was popular, and was steadily building up her own clientele with her talented work. It seemed like everything was going right for Katie. Up until May 1992, when her boyfriend, a man named Martin Mustafa, broke up with her. Katie's heart absolutely shattered when Martin broke up with her. He was her first proper serious boyfriend who she was head over heels in love with. This was the man she saw a future with. This was the man she wanted to marry and start a family with. And now all of that has come to an end. The breakup sent Katie into a depressive episode and she sparsely left the house, only really leaving to go to work where everyone noticed a shift in her mood. After a couple of weeks of this, Katie's friends decided that enough was enough, and after some pushy persuasion, they managed to convince Katie to join them on a night out to let her hair down, stop thinking about Martin, and just have some fun being really good friends. On the 6th of June 1992, sporting a white crop top, navy trousers, ankle boots and a blue jacket, 18-year-old Katie was ready to let loose with her best friends. They all made their way to a club in Camberley called Ragamuffins, where all night long the girls sang, danced, got drunk and were having an amazing time together. Martin was right at the back of Katie's mind, up until she caught sight of him out the corner of her eye. She done what I think every recently split up drunk ex-girlfriend would do when seeing their ex-boyfriend out, and she went up to him and began pleading for him back, expressing that she loved him, she missed him, she wanted to be with him, she wanted to make it work, but Martin was having none of it. Katie persisted, even borderline begged, and Martin turned to her saying he wasn't interested, and he was now with another girl. Katie stopped for a moment, taking this in. Martin had abruptly broke up with her, and now he had moved on. They were never going to be getting back together. Tears brimming at her eyes, Katie looked up to Martin and asked him one final question. Would he please take her home? To which he coldly replied, no, before turning on his heels and storming away from her. After this, there was no way that Katie could go back to her friends and continue with her night. She was devastated, and all she wanted to do was go home, climb into her comfy warm bed and cry. She stormed out of Ragamuffins and began walking home in the dead of night when a car pulled up alongside her, asking if she wanted a lift. Katie peers inside and she sees two boys. She goes to refuse up until she notices there's a young girl sat in the back seat. How dangerous or bad could these boys be if they were driving around with a young girl who seemed happy and comfortable, relaxed? Using this rationale, Katie climbed into the vehicle, sitting herself beside 12-year-old Sharon Carr. Sharon Louise Carr was born on the 21st of December 1979. She was one of four children to an abusive alcoholic father and an equally abusive mother named Molly. The family lived in Belize, which is a country on the northeast coast of Central America, and where they lived was quite poverty-stricken. Their family, like most of the other families in the community, were extremely poor, living in really small, run-down homes and sometimes having to go periods of time without any food or water. This, as you can imagine, caused a lot of tension and frustration within the family home, and more often than not, the parents were arguing, fighting, and the children often got the backlash of their anger. It wasn't unusual for the children to receive beatings from both Molly and their dad. Molly, though, would take the abuse to a whole other level. For example, when disciplining or punishing the children, she would either burn them or put hot pepper on their genitals. So growing up in these conditions was obviously horrible for the kids. They essentially had to fend for themselves, they raised themselves, and they lived day to day on high alert in constant fear. Molly left her husband or partner or whatever he was when she met an English man named George. George worked for the British Army and he was stationed in Belize, and that is how he and Molly crossed paths. They began a relationship, and when George's time in Belize was over and he was heading back home to England, Molly saw this as an opportunity for a better life, so she packed everything up and made the move with George. She did bring Sharon along with her, who was 7 years old at the time, but I couldn't find any details about any of her siblings, any of the other kids, so I don't know if they stayed in Belize or if they were brought over to England too. They weren't really mentioned again at all after this. Molly, George and Sharon all settled in Camberley, Surrey in 1986, and initially Sharon really struggled adjusting to this new life. It was a real culture shock, everything was different, but then at the same time she was doing really well. She began attending Cornwallis Junior School, where she was described by teachers as polite, kind and helpful. She had fun playing basketball at school and managed to make a nice little group of friends who would describe her as very social. Her life at home, though, didn't massively change. She would still witness domestic violence very often, and she sort of grew a tolerance of it. Domestic violence, witnessing violence, wasn't anything new to Sharon. It was essentially just a part of her normal everyday life. Not too long after their arrival in England, George decided that he was over this relationship with Molly. He was sick of the drama, and it's safe to assume that she was abusive to him, like how she was to her partner back in Belize. Determined to end their relationship, George arrived to Molly's house, knocked on her door, and told her that he wanted to leave her. This infuriated Molly. She was so consumed with rage that she turned around, marched into the kitchen, grabbed a big pot of boiling cooking fat that she had on her hob, and doused George in it. Sharon stood in clear view of all of this happening, heard George cry as the boiling fat burned on his skin, and he later recalled that she had no reaction to it whatsoever. She wasn't scared or crying. She didn't even flinch. He was rushed to the hospital with serious burn injuries, and Molly was arrested and charged with assault. Guildford Crown Court handed Molly a suspended sentence and ordered her to receive mental health therapy for 3 years. A suspended sentence means that she didn't have to go to prison, however she did have to follow rules set by the court, the attendance to therapy being one of them. Whether she attended or not, I don't know. At some point, I don't know exactly when, Molly introduced Sharon into practicing voodoo. This included Sharon participating in animal sacrifices, killing live animals. She was taught how to recite rituals that would allegedly allow Sharon to have complete control over whoever she was putting this spell on, and she was taught how to recite rituals to cause great harm to others. It's believed that this is where Sharon began developing a fixation on death and killing. Rapidly, the pets in their street started disappearing or turning up dead. Most of the people on the street knew that it was Sharon who was making their pets disappear or killing them, but by now she had a very nasty reputation. Her and her mum had literally just poured boiling Coogan fat on her partner. So Sharon and Molly were both people that were feared, so none of the neighbours really done or said anything. Sharon was even pretty open about the animal abuse. She once took pride in admitting that she had decapitated a dog using a spade. Sharon in primary school and Sharon in secondary school were like two completely different girls. In secondary school, she began knocking around with the wrong crowd, which was mostly made up of boys who were a lot older than her and were a very bad influence. She began to shoplift. She carried a knife with her at all times, even when she was going to school. She bought and sold drugs and began abusing cannabis at only 11 years old. Using and abusing any sort of drugs, especially at such a young age, can have a detrimental effect on the brain's development, which is something I will circle back to later. Sharon's behaviour began to rapidly decline. She became disruptive, she would be violent and aggressive, she had a real problem with authority figures / being told what to do. Because of these behaviours, her head teacher at Collingwood College Comprehensive School made a report to social services. In 1990, after this report was made, Sharon would be removed from her home, but she was returned to Molly only a month later. I don't know where Molly was or what she was doing throughout this whole time that Sharon's shoplifting, carrying knives, dealing drugs. I don't know what she's doing, but I do know that she had got into another relationship with a new boyfriend and he had moved into the house, so likely all of Molly's attention was on him, and likely this started up another cycle of tension and domestic violence. So it's very early hours on the 7th of June 1992 when 12-year-old Sharon is out and about roaming the streets in a car with two older boys. I don't know how much older they are, but if they're old enough to drive, I don't think they have any business hanging around with a 12-year-old. Sharon and these boys then spot Katie, who is clearly distressed, leaving the Ragamuffins Club and walking along the road, presumably towards the direction of her house. They pull up beside her, offering her a lift, and Katie, who has just had the worst ending to her night, being told that her ex-boyfriend, who she is still in love with, didn't want her back and that he had moved on. She's drunk, she's tired, she just wants to get home, and so she accepts the offer and climbs into the car, probably feeling safer that there's a child with these two boys. The person driving just kind of cruises around the streets for a while, taking his time, and Katie notices they're not going in the direction of her house. They're actually going in the complete opposite direction towards somewhere called Farnborough. They drive to a dark, desolate, isolated sort of parky area, and overwhelmed with panic and fear, having a gut instinct that something is wrong, Katie opens the door and bolts out of the car, sprinting away from Sharon and the boys. Sharon tumbles out of the car and begins to hunt Katie down, chasing after her. She quite quickly catches up and begins to repeatedly stab Katie from behind using a 6.5-inch knife. After Katie drops to the ground, Sharon uncontrollably and viciously continues to stab her in a frenzy, some of the stabs being so ferocious that they went straight through Katie's body. Sharon continued this attack even after Katie was well past dead, enjoying it and soaking up each and every second. She proceeds to prolong the attack by mutilating Katie, slashing at her face, her breasts, and her intimate areas. In total, Katie sustained 32 separate injuries at the hand of this 12-year-old girl who was a complete stranger. Katie's half-naked, blood-soaked body is then dragged and slumped up against the wall of a cemetery and then left. She will be discovered a couple of hours later by a group of four young boys who were out for an early morning walk following a night of camping. The police were notified and eventually the body would be identified as that of 18-year-old Katie Ratcliffe. A murder investigation quickly began and naturally one of the first people officers wanted to speak to was Madden. When a woman is murdered, it's more likely to be from someone she knows, more often, partners. The 2020 census showed that in 2020, 110 women were killed by men, and 52% of the murders were committed by the woman's current or former partner. 8% of the murders were committed by a stranger, so it's safe to say that majority of the time, it is the partner. When Martin found out that Katie had been murdered, he completely broke down. He was absolutely hysterical. He was full of regret, blaming himself, telling the officers, quote, "If only I had taken Katie home, she would be alive today. That will haunt me for the rest of my life." Following this, he was quite quickly eliminated as a suspect. Police done a press release asking anyone who was in or around the Ragamuffins nightclub on the evening of the murder to come forward if they had any information. If they had seen Katie, if they had seen her leave with someone, if they saw someone following her, anything. They did get a couple of leads from this, but none of them aided in getting closer to Katie's killer. Something that stuck with the investigators that was really standing out to them was where Katie was found. She was found in Farnborough, which was the opposite direction of where she should have been. She didn't really have any friends or any reason to go that way, so this was a big question mark for them. How did she end up there? Was she so drunk that she had wandered off in the wrong direction and was at the wrong place at the wrong time? Had she left willingly with someone and ended up there? Had someone abducted her and taken her there? Had she been abducted and murdered and that's just where her body was dumped? There were so many questions surrounding how Katie managed to get to Farnborough. Investigators began creating a criminal profile on the killer based off of the murder. They determined that the killer was likely a man in his early to mid 30s, that he had a strong build, maybe he enjoyed going to the gym. They believed that the killer had to be someone who was strong because of the ferocity of the wounds and the fact that they had to overpower Katie. The wounds also told investigators that whoever committed this crime enjoyed what they were doing. Some of Katie's wounds were so deep and others were more like smaller slashes, almost as if the killer was trying to prolong the murder as much as they could. They also believed that there was a sexual motive behind the murder due to Katie's breasts and intimate areas being mutilated. They came up with this profile along with a photo fit and got tunnel vision trying to find this person. Sadly, despite all of their best efforts following tips and leads, investigating different suspects and doing everything that they could, they got no closer to solving Katie's murder and the case began to go cold. Over the next 2 years, Sharon Carr would write entries in her diary relishing in what she had done, detailing the whole murder and her arousal from it. She wrote entries saying things such as, quote, "I bring the knife into her chest. Her eyes are closing. She is pleading with me, so I bring the knife to her again and again. I don't want to hurt her, but I need to do violence to her. I need to overcome her beauty, her serenity, her security. There I see her face when she died. I know she feels her life being slowly drawn away from her, and I hear her gasp. I guess she was trying to breathe." And quote, "If only I could kill you again, I promise I would. You suffer more this time, you fucking slag. Your terrified scream turns me on," and more, which I will go into further shortly. As Sharon's diary entry progresses, she becomes more graphic and more confident in her writing. She wanted to be able to remember every single fine detail. She was aware that the police were looking in the complete wrong direction for Katie's killer, and she really got gratification from this. Here she was, 12-year-old girl committing a murder and fooling the police, having all the power. The way she was writing and what she was writing, you can tell that she's really trying to relive it. She's trying to get that rush again to the same extent that she had when she committed the murder. But writing it was never going to get her close to that high. on the second anniversary of Katie's murder, the 7th of June 1994, Sharon wrote in her diary about her desire to murder again, but that this murder would be different. This murder would be even more brutal and last much longer so that she could listen to the painful screams and enjoy it. This entry wasn't just a fantasy for Sharon, this was a plan that she had full intentions to carry out. So on that day, again, 7th of June 1994, the second anniversary of Katie's murder, Sharon, who was now 14, lured a fellow pupil into the toilets at their school. She approached 13-year-old Anne-Marie Clifford, telling her that she'd lost a pound coin in the toilets and that she needed help finding it. Like I mentioned earlier, Sharon is very much a feared bully, so when she approached Anne-Marie under the rouse of needing help, Anne-Marie felt like she didn't really have a choice but to follow Sharon into the toilets. She was too scared to refuse. Upon entering the toilets, Sharon forcefully pushed Anne-Marie onto the floor and towered over her. She then reached into her bag and pulled out a 4-inch knife. Terrified, Anne-Marie recalls Sharon laughing, passing the knife between her hands, seemingly bursting with excitement for what she was about to do. Scared for her life, Anne-Marie pounced up from the floor and tried to make a run for it back to the door, but Sharon knocked her to the ground again, raised her arm and stabbed Anne-Marie in the back. At that exact moment, a group of 5 other girls came into the toilet, which thankfully prevented Sharon from continuing the assault. The single stab wound that Anne-Marie sustained punctured her lung, and crimson blood was gushing out of her. She would be quickly rushed to the hospital for life-saving treatment, where thankfully she survived the attack. Back at school, Sharon was immediately arrested and was taken for a psychological assessment, but she was just still so full of adrenaline and on a high from the attack that she wanted to keep going. She would assault 2 members of staff at the facility where they were trying to help her by strangling them. She was quickly deemed too dangerous to be there, so was transported to a Young Offenders Institute. In December 1994, after these attacks, Sharon was convicted of actual body harm and was sentenced to be detained at Her Majesty's pleasure. This means that there was no minimum term to serve, there was no set time that she would be incarcerated. Sharon would be incarcerated until it was decided that it was safe to release her. For several months, Sharon was kind of bouncing between psychiatric units, never really staying anywhere for long periods of time because she would always cause trouble and would instigate fights. In September 1995, she was transferred to Bulwood Hall Young Offenders Unit, where they seemed to be able to manage her better. While here at Bulwood Hall, staff noticed that Sharon really liked to talk, specifically about this years-old murder case. She would talk on the phone about it, not really direct, but kind of tiptoed around it. She had took a liking to one of the male prison guards, and she would talk to him about this murder too. She spoke about it enough that it actually began to concern the staff, so they reported this to the police, who linked the little details that Sharon spoke about to a murder case that was now almost 4 years old, which was the murder of Katie Ratcliffe. Officers conducted a search of Sharon's room and seized her diary, which when they read it, they couldn't believe what disturbing material was inside. Inside this diary, which Sharon had had for years, she details murdering Katie and the sexual excitement that she got from it. She had drawings of the knife that she used to murder Katie. She referred to herself as the devil, saying, quote, "Overnight I see the devil in my dreams, sometimes even in the mirror, but I realise it was just me." She wrote even more disturbing things, such as, quote, "I was born to be a murderer. Killing for me is a mass turn on and it just makes me so high that I never want to come down. I swear I was born to be a murderer. I'm a killer. Killing is my business and business is good." She talks about Katie's final moments, saying, quote, "The air stops in the back of her throat. I know all her life her breathing has worked, but now it does not, and I am joyful." Every year on the anniversary of Katie's murder, Sharon would dedicate an entry to Katie. As I mentioned earlier, on the second anniversary, she wrote about her desire to kill again, then proceeded to attack Anne-Marie in school. On the third year anniversary, she wrote, quote, "Killed K.R. The death by knife wounds and sex go together." On the fourth year anniversary, she wrote, quote, "Respect to Katie Ratcliffe. 4 years ago today." I'm also pretty sure that the entry that was wrote on the fourth year anniversary, Sharon wrote after she was eventually charged for Katie's murder. Police obviously decided that they needed to speak with Sharon. Although the things in her diary were disturbing, to say the least, this didn't prove with certainty that Sharon had actually committed murder. For all they know, she could have just had a vivid imagination and a keen interest in the case. Honestly, the thought that a 12-year-old girl could have committed such a horrific crime was quite unbelievable to the police. They fully believed that they were after a stocky 30-year-old man, and now they're presented with a 12-year-old girl as their potential killer. When questioned about Katie's murder, Sharon fully confessed and she did not hold back. She was questioned for about 27 hours over a number of days, where she actually done most of the talking. She spoke fluidly about the murder and with excitement. She had held this in for years, only really daring to share small details like how she did to that prison officer. But now she's confessing, she's no longer hiding, she's letting it all out and she's excited. Here is another opportunity for her to relive it. The interviewer described Sharon as, quote, "being on another universe," while detailing it. In her confession, Sharon spoke about graphic injury details that were withheld from the public that only the killer would know. She also told them about a bracelet that she had stolen off of Katie's wrist, which was something else that wasn't public knowledge. So these details solidified her confession. Sharon was telling the truth. She had murdered Katie Ratcliffe. Sharon showed absolutely no remorse while relaying Katie's murder, and in fact, she would even laugh at some points. During her interviews, she did mix up some details. The version of events that I told you about earlier is what is believed to have happened. The details that she mixed up were just sort of small details, but the thick of the story is the same. For example, in one version, she said that she alone had dragged Katie's body from the murder scene to that cemetery wall. But the officers found this unbelievable, as Katie's body would have been too heavy. I think the Probleys underestimated Sharon's strength. Again, they thought they were looking for a 30-year-old man, but here is Sharon, a 12-year-old girl. In another version, she contradicted, saying that she alone had moved the body by saying that the two boys that she was with in the car helped her move the body. She provided police with their names. Police tracked the boys down, questioned them, and discovered that both boys had alibis. And in another version, she stated that the attack happened in the car and that is what caused Katie to run away. So again, these are very small details, but the thick of what happened is the same. What is consistent throughout every single interview that Sharon done was that she alone was responsible for the murder and she was proud of it. At one point, I don't know exactly when, Sharon is diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. This diagnosis is kind of on the spectrum of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. The schizo symptoms is psychosis, meaning that it can cause hallucinations or delusions, and the affective refers to mood symptoms, so this can cause feeling episodes of deep depression and episodes of mania. Obviously, having this diagnosis doesn't justify Katie's murder whatsoever. One in every 200 people have schizoaffective disorder, and they're not all sadistic murderers like Sharon, they're just normal people. As I mentioned earlier, Sharon had been abusing drugs from only 11 years old, so I wonder, could this have been something that triggered or caused the schizoaffective disorder? Sharon Carr would be officially charged with the murder of Katie Ratcliffe in May 1996. Her trial was held at Winchester Crown Court in February 1997, where she entered a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. The trial lasted for around about a month. The jury deliberated for only 5 hours before returning with their verdict. On the 25th of March 1997, Sharon Carr was unanimously found guilty of the murder of Katie Ratcliffe. Upon hearing this verdict, Katie's dad jumped from the gallery, punching the air, shouting yes, he had finally saw justice being served for his daughter after almost 5 years. This verdict also gave Sharon the title of Britain's youngest female murderer, having committed the murder at only age 12. Some people will confuse Sharon Carr with Mary Bell for this title. Mary Bell killed 2 children from Newcastle, killing her first victim when she was only 10 years old herself. However, she was convicted of manslaughter, not murder, so that's why youngest female murderer goes to Sharon. And I'm pretty sure she's very proud of that title. At the end of the trial, the judge remarked to Sharon, saying, quote, "What is clear is that you had a sexual motive for this killing, and it is apparent both from the brutal manner in which you mutilated her body and the chilling entries in your diary that killing, as you put it, turns you on. You are, in my view, an extremely dangerous young woman." Sharon would go on to be sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum of 14 years to serve. She smiled as her sentence was read out and as she left the courtroom. Her team have since filed several appeals against this murder conviction, however, each and every one has been dismissed. Sharon began her sentence at HMP Holloway, but was transferred to the infamous Broadmoor Hospital in 1998. Here, she continued her violent and aggressive behaviour, regularly getting into fight with other patients and assaulting staff members. However, she did find love and was even going to get married. She, now 21, met Robbie Lane, who was 24, during some very rare recreational time inside of Broadmoor, and seemingly they hit it off immediately. They were allowed supervised visits to each other's rooms or cells every month, and they even saved up money to purchase wedding rings from Argos. In the days leading up to their wedding, a newspaper wrote about their plans to get married, and within the article, they detailed both Sharon and Robbie's crimes. Robbie had murdered his own mother by beating her, stabbing her, then proceeding to gouge her eyes out. He did this in a fit of jealousy because he thought that she favoured his sister over him. After reading the article and learning what the other one had done, both Sharon and Robbie became repulsed by each other and were, quote, "so shocked, horrified, and disgusted by the ferocity of each other's murders." And because of this, they immediately called off the wedding and never spoke again. How bizarre is that, that these two people who committed equally horrible, horrific crimes became disgusted by each other's heinous acts? In 2015, then 36, Sharon was transferred to HMP Bronzefield as a restricted status prisoner. This meant that she was held in a closed prison and spent a lot of her time in solidarity. Sharon was moved to HMP Low Newton, where infamous child killer Rose West was incarcerated for a period of time. Sharon didn't last long here though. Her violent tendencies were still very much there, and she attacked her cellmate with the goal of murdering her. Back at HMP Bronzefield in 2020, Sharon applied for her restricted status to be downgraded. However, she was still considered a very dangerous prisoner who was a risk to others. She hadn't proven otherwise because she was still attacking other people, getting into fights whenever she could, so of course her request was denied. The judge who denied this request justified his ruling, saying, quote, "She disclosed thoughts of wanting to murder another resident by slitting her head open with a flask and throwing her down the stairs to snap her neck." Sharon is now 44, and this year will be her 30th year spent behind bars. In August 2023, she had her bid for parole denied. It's likely that she will spend the rest of her natural life behind bars, as she is still, after so long, deemed too dangerous to be released. Thank Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, please make sure to leave me a nice review and to follow the podcast wherever you're listening. I would appreciate that so much. You can follow the podcast over on Instagram at TrueCrimeCaitlinPod, where I'll be posting images relating to all the cases and for any updates. Make sure you tune in again next week for a brand new episode.